From Uniontown to Middletown, Tyrone to Carlisle, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, as we head into the end of the year, what is the state of the nation's economy? Sean Higgins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here to discuss. The city of Pittsburgh established a land bank to deal with blighted properties, but the agency was slow out of the starting gate. Eric Montardi and Alex Sodini have an Allegheny Institute report. And the permitting process is often a barrier or at least a speed bump to economic development. The SPEED Act seeks to streamline the regulatory process. Emily Green Bray from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Sean Higgins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. The dust is still settling on the 2025-26 state budget, and already warning bells are going off for the next fiscal year. To fill the gap between spending and revenue in the current state budget, lawmakers took $570 million from special funds to pay for recurring spending, which means the funding will not be there in future years. According to the Independent Fiscal Office, quote, if projections hold, the general fund surplus is depleted in fiscal year 26-27, and the rainy day fund is depleted in fiscal year 2028, end quote. That means unless spending is cut or new sources of revenue are added, the state will face a fiscal cliff in 2028 that could result in massive tax hikes. That is exactly what state Senate Republicans argued would happen during the recent budget stalemate. Once again, the state is providing millions of dollars to the Southeastern Pennsylvania Regional Transit Authority, or SEPTA, without requiring any reforms or belt tightening. Governor Josh Shapiro announced the release of $29.9 million in capital funds. The money is to be used for emergency repairs to vehicles mandated by the federal government. An additional $17 million will be spent on leasing rail cars from the Maryland Transit Administration. Workers at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette have ended the longest strike in the country. It lasted more than 3 years. The newspaper continued to publish despite the strike by journalists represented by the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh. The walkout ends after the National Labor Relations Board found the paper had not negotiated in good faith, and a three-judge panel of the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued an order reinstating terms of the previous contract. The resumption of work may be short-lived, however. The Post-Gazette has the right to appeal that ruling. This is interesting. The Pennsylvania Health Department cannot account for more than two-thirds of the $29 million it spent on emergency management services since 2021. State Auditor General Timothy DeFore released his findings and cited the agency for a lack of internal controls in dispersing the funding to emergency services around the state. No word on whether anybody will be held responsible or if it will be possible to account for the spending. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. After a delay caused by the partial federal government shutdown, we now have jobs and unemployment numbers for September. To find out what they tell us about the health of the U.S. economy, we turn to Sean Higgins. He is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Sean, numbers were delayed a bit as a result of the partial federal government shutdown, but we now have some jobs numbers. Can you give us an overview as to what time frame we're now talking about and what those numbers are showing?
Last week, the Labor Department finally released the jobs numbers they had for September, which they show that the unemployment edged up by 119,000, and the unemployment rate rose to 4.4%, by, I believe, a point from 4.3. And this was a bit of a surprise. It was better than predicted. The last couple of months had been bad, although It's also worth noting that they downgraded the previous month's numbers to the point where August actually had negative job growth by about 2,000. Previously, they'd reported about 24,000 a gain. Basically, employment ticked up and was better than people expected, but it's still not as good as it was the previous years, and we're still having a sort of stagnant year overall. The question is, why did it pick up a little bit? My personal theory on this is that some of the controversy around the tariffs has died down a bit, and businesses are getting a bit more willing to hire again.
Relative to those tariffs, did you see in the job creation numbers that were prior to all the tariff controversy taking place and the tariffs now having been somewhat in place, they do seem to change quite frequently, did you see a real change in the job creation numbers pre and post tariff?
The numbers over the summer were very bad, dropping down to just to five-figure gains, which was far below where it was before, and that's not surprising in the face of tariffs. I mean, the issue businesses have to plan long term. They need to look ahead to the next 3 or 6 months or even a year, and in order to do that, you have to know what the prices are going to be. You have to know how much of your product you can sell abroad. You have to know how much the raw materials you're going to have to import are going to cost. If you don't know what those prices are, you're going to be very reluctant to make any kind of investments, and you're going to hold off on hiring. So that, you know, pushed things back. And part of the problem here was, as you said, the tariffs themselves have been extremely volatile. The administration will announce something, then there'll be some sort of political blow up or pushback from the other side, and then they'll drop something, and then for whatever reason, Trump will decide he wants to push back himself, and then they'll go back up, and you go through this process a couple of times, and so no one really knows where they're going to be from now. One of the interesting things is I do think it's impacted employment. It hasn't actually impacted inflation much, and that's because most businesses appear to be sort of eating the cost for the time being because they don't really know where the tariffs are going to be in the future.
In terms of these jobs that are being created, is this uniform across the country? Are there some geographic areas of the country, the South, the West, the Northeast, anybody doing better than anybody else, or is this a national phenomenon?
Yeah, there's little to no change really in most industries. I mean, there's been some gains across the board, but they've been modest in pretty much all sectors. So while there's been some general increase, No one appears to be doing particularly better than others. And also, one of the interesting factors is the numbers may actually be worse than they're currently being stated right now, because there's also the government furloughs or layoffs, which have happened. And technically, the BLS counts a lot of those people as still being employed if they're still receiving severance pay, even if they don't officially have a job anymore. So we're going to probably see in the next month or two a significant shift in numbers when those people actually start appearing in the surveys.
So does that mean the numbers are likely now going to bounce around a little bit? Because we did have a rather long partial government shutdown. It extended through the whole month of October, but then was over in November. So can we expect maybe some volatility going forward?
Absolutely. There's going to be space for the numbers to drop, but then there's also pushback on that. One of the parts of the deal was to reverse some of the layoffs that occurred specifically as a result of the shutdown. And there's also challenges to some of the layoffs that happened before that. So, you know, the courts could affect things a bit. So, yeah, we're still going to see a lot of volatility probably in the next 2 or 3 months at least.
I find it interesting. You mentioned that the August job numbers were significantly revised. Sean, we seem to see that quite a bit, where you have a jobs number and a couple months later, there's a very significant revision, not just a few thousand, but hundreds of thousands sometimes, of jobs that are revised. Why do we see such wild swings in terms of revisions?
It has to do with the way the BLS gathers the data. They literally just send out surveys to businesses and wait for them to be filled out and sent back via mail or email or however. And as a consequence, it's sort of catch-as-catch-can. What happens is they get maybe 60% of the surveys back in time for that month's report, and so they'll make a report based on that, and then a month later when they get another 25% or 30% of them come back in, they'll revise it based on that. And so that's why the numbers are constantly being fiddled with after the fact, is because they don't actually have all the data at the time when they're releasing the monthly reports. And it's basically just an old school kind of analog way of doing it. I mean, the BLS has been using the same methods for doing this since going back at least 50 years or so. And it just really hasn't changed much. And that's one of the sort of issues the BLS has, is there's got to be a better way to do this in the age of the internet and social media to survey these things, but they haven't figured out how to do that. And so they're still stuck in these sort of old fashioned ways of doing it. And one of the factors in that is just a delay in getting good information.
We are talking with Sean Higgins, a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We'll talk a little bit more about CEI in a couple of minutes. But Sean, in terms of employment, you've given us the employment numbers. What about unemployment? Where do we stand with unemployment numbers?
The number is currently 4.4% in the official sort of rate, which is, I would bore your listeners by saying this, but there's actually six different numbers that the Labor Department comes out with each month for unemployment. But for reasons I've never quite understood, the third calculation they use is the official one that you see in all the news headlines and that type of stuff, and that's 4.4%. Now, historically, that's actually good. There's a long time for when about 5% was actually considered functional full employment, because you're always going to have some businesses going out of business and people quitting one job and looking for another, or new people entering the workforce, so there's always going to be a certain amount of churn. On the other hand, we saw unemployment dip down as low as 3.5% in recent years, so it's up significantly over the past year.
We don't want to get too heavily into immigration policy here, but just from a high level, Sean, has the crackdown on illegal immigration had any impact on jobs numbers? Are we seeing a lot more job openings that are unfilled than what we've seen in the past?
We probably are seeing some of that. Immigration is interesting because even if someone's not legally in the country, they typically are being counted in these surveys. And a lot of other federal laws still apply. I mean, basically, the way federal labor law works is it all applies to the employer. So if you're hiring somebody, whether they're supposed to be in the country legally or not, all this stuff still goes into play. And so, yeah, I think that may actually be in part. Certainly, farm employment and stuff is impacted by this, and I think construction is as well. One of the things you have to understand is that while these openings happen, I mean, the economy doesn't always respond that quickly or dynamically to this type of stuff. I mean, if you've been relying on this type of labor for a while and suddenly it's not available to you, you're not necessarily immediately going to be able to turn around and find other people to replace it. So there's going to be some lag in terms of how you adapt or adopt things. And so, yeah, we're going to be seeing some of that. As to how much actually, I'm not sure actually how many people have been deported so far and how permanent that has been. So it's still a little unclear as to what the total impact has been, though.
Interesting. You made the comment here, Sean, that things don't turn around real quick when it comes to the economy, because we don't have, maybe it's more centralized than what we would actually like it to be, but it isn't. There's not one or two people who direct the economy. In terms of inflation, you referenced earlier in our discussion here that the inflation numbers really haven't ticked up a lot. However, on the political front, there seems to be a lot of emphasis these days on affordability. And for some reason, folks are thinking that inflation remains out of control. Relatively speaking, where the inflation rate is right now, is it about normal? Is it still running hot? And why does it take so long to turn things around?
Well, yeah, let me clarify that a little bit. Inflation was running high even before the tariffs were coming along, and the assumption was that the tariffs would inflate it, make it even hotter than it was previously, and that doesn't appear to have been the case, at least not thus far, for the reasons I said. Basically, businesses are sort of eating the costs from these tariffs at the moment because they don't really know where they're going to settle and where they should put their prices at. So that's been sort of a surprise, but that doesn't mean the inflation isn't there and isn't still rising, and something that a lot of people are seeing, particularly in sort of food bills at this time. So it is up there and it is impacting people. It's just that, frankly, people thought it would be worse than it is.
In terms of interest rates, we are awaiting a decision here by the Federal Reserve in the next week or two as to whether they're going to cut their target rate. Do interest rates have any impact on the number of jobs that are being created? Are we seeing maybe some holding back of creating jobs because businesses can't afford to borrow the capital that they need in order to expand?
I think we are seeing some of that because they don't really know where the Federal Reserve is going to come. The September jobs data just isn't very useful in terms of predicting where the decision is going to be coming up. And so everybody's sort of floating around in this kind of limbo where they don't really know what's going to happen next. And in those situations, they tend to get very small C conservative and hold back. So yeah, there isn't as much investment and there isn't as much future planning or expansion going on, which would require hiring.
Sean Higgins, again, is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, tell us a bit about the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Also, where can we find you on the web?
We're a free market think tank located right in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C. You can find us at CEI.org.
Sean Higgins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, thank you for taking time to be with us.
No problem.
Municipalities often establish land banks as a mechanism for rehabilitating blighted properties. The city of Pittsburgh has tried that course of action, and it is finally getting some traction. Eric Montardi and Alex Sodini have details on this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Alex Sodini, Research Associate at the Allegheny Institute. Alex, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, Eric. Thank you for having me.
That's great to hear. Your most recent policy brief, which is available at our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, talks about land banks and Pittsburgh's experience with the land bank. Can you give our listeners a background on what a land bank is and how they are created?
Act 153 of 2012 allowed municipalities with a population greater than 10,000 to create a land bank to more efficiently combat blighted, vacant, and abandoned property. The land bank is a locally created independent corporation that operates within the boundaries of a municipality but is not part of the government itself. It is going to be dealing with properties that are difficult for local governments to deal with due to tax delinquencies, other financial and legal obstacles, and then obviously it's going to be trying to move those back onto the tax rolls and to productive use. It's given special powers by state law in acquiring these types of properties, and then an expedited ability to clear titles, meaning it is going to be clearing competing claims of ownership from liens, from back taxes or unpaid utilities or mortgages, etc. And it's going to be doing this by filing a quiet title action in court, which is still going to be a lengthy process, but is far quicker than a municipality would be able to do on its own. Statewide, there are now a total of 39 land banks. Pittsburgh officially passed its ordinance creating the Pittsburgh Land Bank in 2014, but as we'll talk about, the city nor the land bank has made great strides in addressing blighted, vacant, and abandoned properties.
Give our listeners a summary then of what's gone on with the land bank in the last decade.
While the ordinance creating the Pittsburgh Land Bank was passed in 2014, the land bank did not make its first sale until almost a decade later in 2023. One news editorial described the Pittsburgh Land Bank's state during that time as bureaucratic suspended animation, which I think pretty much sums it up. First, there was a real lack of funding and personnel, which obviously makes it difficult to do much of anything. There was also a lot that needed done internally in terms of policy and procedures and administrative tasks, which overall created a difficult environment for the land bank to operate in. The major game changer was a $3.5 million allocation from the City of Pittsburgh's American Rescue Plan funds in 2021, which was actually originally $10 million, then to $7 million, then down to $3.5 million, which ultimately helped with the funding issue and then ironing out some of the internal and administrative issues, along with new leadership and a new board. One of the other major drivers was an amended tri-party cooperation agreement with the Urban Redevelopment Authority, the Pittsburgh Land Bank, and the City of Pittsburgh, so the land bank could actually transfer from the city and not just to. These developments really helped the land bank get the ball rolling, but it wasn't exactly flying straight out of the gate. The land bank's website lists 10 total sales combined between 2023 and 2024, and most of these included side yards, green spaces, playground, and affordable housing units. And then the 2024 annual report showed about 60 properties were in its inventory. And then as of the November 14th board meeting, the land bank had sold 74 properties in 2025, which was obviously a huge step up compared to 2023 and 2024, and then obviously the grand total of zero before that. Now the next step in the land bank's trajectory is the signing of an intergovernmental cooperation agreement with the three taxing bodies: the City of Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh Public Schools, Rose, and then Allegheny County.
What is the goal of this recent agreement?
Currently, the land bank can acquire properties which do not sell through the city's treasurer sale process. This is essentially a public sale or auction for properties that owe taxes to the three taxing bodies or utilities to Pittsburgh Water, for example. The treasurer sale process, unfortunately, does not fully quiet the title, and so therefore the Pittsburgh Land Bank also then sort of gets the worst of the worst properties that don't sell. By contrast, there is a similar type of property sale called the sheriff sale, which occurs far more often, usually involves properties which are in not as dire or deteriorated condition, and the sheriff sale also results in a quiet title. This sounds like a far better place for the land bank to acquire properties. The issue is that Act 153 of 2012 stipulated that to use the sheriff sale effectively, the Pittsburgh Land Bank would need a formal agreement with the three taxing bodies as to how to process properties, extinguish tax delinquencies, and then set up a clear title. To further sweeten the deal, Act 4 of 2023 was a specific carve-out for Pittsburgh's land bank, which streamlined the sheriff sale process even further and would give the Pittsburgh Land Bank a priority bid to acquire properties. Hence, an intergovernmental cooperation agreement with the three taxing bodies and the land bank was needed to begin to effectively use the sheriff sale. Pittsburgh Land Bank would also get 50% of new property taxes owed to the taxing bodies for 5 years on properties that it sells due to the agreement. And then in exchange, the school board and county executive could each appoint a member to the Pittsburgh Land Bank's board, which would bring the total from 9 to 11. As of November 19th, there was a ceremonial signing of the agreement by all three taxing bodies, which will hopefully help the land bank get more properties back onto the tax rolls.
Well, it sounds like things are setting up quite nicely for the land bank, but there's probably going to be other actions that are needed. So what else can the city of Pittsburgh be doing in order to aid the land bank in its goals?
While the signing of the Intergovernmental Cooperation Agreement is significant, there are definitely still lingering concerns about how expeditiously and successfully the land bank can move properties back to productive use. First, the land bank's allocation of $3.5 million must be spent by 2026, and so a new funding stream needs to be identified, ideally from economizing resources in the city's budget rather than raising taxes to support it. A task force created by City Council in the summer is working to identify potential long-term solutions with a report expected to release soon. One option up for consideration is dues from the taxing bodies, which is something done for other land banks, but this could be difficult given the financial strain on all three taxing bodies. So far, most of the sales I mentioned are relatively minor additions to the property tax rules as well, which is to be expected for some, but is artificially steered due to roadblocks at the city level and the Pittsburgh Land Bank's non-competitive disposition process, which favors such sales. Currently, the Pittsburgh Land Bank mostly acquires properties which have an interested party or buyer identified. This is in part due to its own funding constraints, but also to ensure proper stewardship, sufficient scope for community engagement, and adequate financing. As such, a comprehensive examination of land use policy could help further maximize the Pittsburgh Land Bank's potential to return properties to productive use. Emphasis must be placed on lowering barriers to construction and development for both residential property and commercial businesses. This could be done by streamlining permitting processes, addressing restrictive elements of the zoning code, and eliminating or at the very least relaxing other onerous land use mandates such as minimum parking requirements. Simply put, the more hurdles, stipulations, and requirements such as affordable housing mandates placed on potential buyers and developers by the city and or the land bank, the more difficult it will be to find, encourage, and attract development and investment and ultimately return more of these properties to the tax rolls.
Great stuff, Alex. Thank you so much for sharing that with our listeners. For Alex Sedini, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
All of us here at Lincoln Radio Journal offer our congratulations to Emily Green, now Emily Green Bray, who got married this last weekend. We wish her and her husband Andrew a lifetime of happiness. She was quickly back to work at her desk and offers us this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Pennsylvania leads the nation in energy production. Now, because of the 119th Congress's swift action, permitting reform is on the move, making it easier for Pennsylvania projects to deliver on providing affordable and dependable energy. Last week marked a major step forward for unleashing abundant American energy. With the SPEED Act moving out of committee, Congress has a real opportunity to cut through the red tape that's been holding back innovators, builders, and communities that are ready to lead. This is the kind of bottom-up progress Americans are hungry for, where people with the know-how to solve problems finally get the freedom to act on it. The SPEED Act does something simple but powerful. It modernizes outdated permitting rules that have slowed down everything from clean energy projects to traditional energy production to critical mineral development. By streamlining and accelerating these processes, we can get shovels in the ground faster, lower energy costs for families, and strengthen our long-term energy security. This is about unleashing energy abundance, not picking winners and losers. Letting ideas, innovation, and competition drive better outcomes. Right now, endless delays and bureaucratic hurdles punish the very people trying to build. That's not how a society rooted in free market policies should function. When we enable the free movement of ideas and resources, when we embrace openness, we empower problem solvers to contribute. We remove the barriers that block innovation and drive up costs. We make room for the creative destruction that leads to cleaner, cheaper, more reliable energy. This is why last week's committee vote is so promising. It signals bipartisan recognition that America can lead the world in energy if we empower our builders instead of burying them in paperwork. It's an acknowledgement that progress comes from the ground up, from entrepreneurs, engineers, and communities who know their local challenges and opportunities far better than Washington does. Now Congress has the chance to finish what the committee started. Passing the SPEED Act swiftly would show the country that we're serious about lowering costs, strengthening supply chains, and unlocking the kind of energy abundance that benefits everyone. This isn't about ideology. It's about practicality. It's about trusting Americans to build. So let's seize the moment. Let's give people the freedom to innovate, invest, and create. Let's move with speed towards an energy future defined by abundance, affordability, and opportunity. Tell your member of Congress that you support the swift passage of the SPEED Act by heading to afppennsylvania.com. Again, sign your name to a petition by checking us out at afppennsylvania.com. This is Emily Green, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. For 30 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WWSM-AM in Lebanon, WRAK-AM in Williamsport, along with WHLM-AM in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.